The first Old Testament reading is from the Ten Commandments in the Exodus version. Listen now for a word from God to the church this day. You shall not make for yourself an idol, whether in the form of anything that is in heaven above, or that is on the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing children for the iniquity of parents to the third and the fourth generation of those who reject me, but showing steadfast love to the thousandth generation of those who love me and keep my commandments. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. And then from the book of Judges, the story of Gideon. Gideon starts out as an anti-idolatry crusader, and it's a sad ending. Then the Israelites said to Gideon, after all of his military conquests, "Rule over us, you and your son, and your grandson also, for you have delivered us out of the hand of Midian." Gideon said to them, "I will not rule over you, and my son will not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you." Then Gideon said to them, "Let me make a request of you. Each of you give me an earring that he has taken as booty." For the enemy had golden earrings because they were Ishmaelites. "We will willingly give them," they answered. So they spread a garment and each threw into it an earring that he had taken as booty. The weight of the golden earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold, apart from the crescents and the pendants and the purple garments worn by the kings of Midian and the collars that were on the necks of their camels. Gideon made an ephod of it and put it in his town in Ophrah, and all Israel prostituted themselves to it there, and it became a snare to Gideon and to his family. So Midian was subdued before the Israelites, and they lifted up their heads no more. So the land had rest 40 years in the days of Gideon. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. Please pray with me. Oh God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be acceptable to you, O God, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. So we were studying the meaning of communion with our Catholic and Episcopal sisters and brothers across the street and down the street. And I gave the Presbyterian perspective. Our real concern with the Catholic understanding of communion, where the bread is transformed into the real presence of Christ, is frankly idolatry, I said. The reason we don't bow before our table or call it an altar is idolatry. Calvin wrote that humanity is a perpetual factory of idols, I told them. Idolatry is giving something in creation our total allegiance when it belongs to the Creator alone. Calvin thought that idolatry was at the roots of so much superstition in the church. And so when we see what looks to us like people kneeling and praying before a wafer in a box, or watch priests bowing before a table, we smell idolatry. And that is why in our church, I told the hushed room, rather than praying in front of wafers or bowing before the table, things that might lead us into idolatry, instead, we have Tiffany windows. Hypocrisy seems to be idolatry's first cousin, which I suppose is how this congregation was able to build an edifice which is so atypically Presbyterian. The vaulted ceilings, the gilded accents, the Tiffany windows, the images that are carved into the wood. The reformers rejected ostentation of any kind, warning that anything that doesn't direct us toward the worship of God directs us toward the worship of something other than God. They got rid of the vestments. What I'm wearing now would be way too popish for the reformers. They got rid of all images. The Swiss reformer, Zwingli, perhaps the most militant of all the reformers, eliminated much of church music. Legend has it that the organist of his church could be seen weeping over the rubble of the great organ that Zwingli had removed and destroyed in the middle of the town. There is a severity in the accusation of idolatry, which probably explains our reluctance to even use this word. I like the fact that we alternate the words that we use to open the Lord's Prayer each week, several people told me when we first started that practice. But when we explain this in the bulletin, do we really have to use the word idolatry? I gave in to the pressure. We changed the language. The Puritans were militant in their efforts to root out idolatry, which is probably one reason that we're not. In the Massachusetts Bay Colony, some were persecuted for their apostasy. Concerns over idolatry led some Puritans to oppose not just sex depicted in drama, but the elimination of all drama. Secular entertainment could lead us away from God. Gambling was outlawed. Celebrating Christmas was banned in Boston in 1659, calling it residual papist idolatry. But the Puritans also had legitimate concerns that some of us have come to adopt voluntarily. Long before the internet, the Puritans observed correctly that the images that we see have consequences. They shape our desires. They shape our wants. They were right to notice that simplicity can be an antidote to the materialism that consumes consumers. Long before there was a Black Friday or Christmas shopping that begins before Thanksgiving, they saw the danger of a religious holiday being hijacked by people looking to use religion to sell a product. Some argue that this concern with idolatry is the very thing that gave democracy a chance to be born. Earthly princes lay aside all their power when they rise up against God, wrote Calvin. We ought to defy than to obey them. Presbyterian minister John Witherspoon, the third president of Princeton University and the only member of the clergy who signed the Declaration of Independence, looked back to Calvin's writings to support their conviction that people have the right and the duty to overthrow unjust governments. Anti-Nazi churches in 1934 quoted the same scripture that Calvin had referenced almost 400 years earlier, "Fear God, honor the emperor." We reject the false doctrine, they wrote, as though the state, over and beyond its special commission, should and could become the single and totalitarian order of human life, thus fulfilling the church's vocation as well. Even Mary Daly, the great feminist, railed against a kind of idolatry in her quest to rid theology of its male assumptions about God. If God is male, she wrote in 1973, then male is God. Paul Tillich, theologian in the 20th century, called this resistance to any claim to absolute truth the Protestant principle. It may be derived from the protests of Protestants against the Catholic Church, he said, but it contains the divine and human protest against any absolute claim made for a relative reality. It contains the divine and human protest against any absolute claim made for a relative reality. It is the judge, he said, of every religious and cultural reality, including the religion and culture which calls itself Protestant. Resistance to idolatry is baked in to our tradition. I think this is the reason why some of us cringe when Americans sing God Bless America at a sporting event as a song of entitlement instead of a fervent plea. I think it is the reason that some of us wince when we hear religious leaders claiming to know who is going to heaven and who is going to hell as if they could know the mind of God or constrain God's freedom. It is the reason that the hair literally rose up on the back of my neck when candidate Trump at the Republican National Convention told a nation not to put our trust in each other or our trust in God, but only in Him. I alone can fix it, he said. And it may be the reason that many of us question our own motives when it comes to our conspicuous consumption or chasing after middle-class myths of what leads to happiness or the rat race that is always threatening to consume our children. No one can serve two masters, Jesus said. You cannot serve God and wealth, the Protestant principle, that theological reflex against anyone or anything that would claim a kind of healing or a kind of power or a kind of salvation that can come only from God. That reflex that rises up in a people who know that humanity is a perpetual factory of idols. That idolatry can sneak up on any of us, whether we claim to worship the true God or not. It certainly snuck up on Gideon. Gideon wasn't just any religious leader. He had started out as an anti-idolatry activist. Called by God, he tears down the altar to the pagan god Baal to begin his leadership campaign. From there, his power grows as he goes after all those who are opposed to God's reign. He routs the Midianites. His campaign turns bloody and violent. The people turn to Gideon. Rule over us, they shout. Unlike some leaders, then and now, Gideon knows the right answer. No, the Lord will rule over you. Yet even God seems to question Gideon's sincerity. At one point, God reduces the size of Gideon's army to a ridiculously small number so that if they win, they will have to claim God as behind the victory. And yet, as Gideon charges into battle, he shouts, "For God and for Gideon." By the end of chapter 8, Gideon's anti-idolatry crusade has turned him into just another tyrant, greedy for power, motivated by vengeance, a judge who claims more authority than he's actually been given. Gideon makes the idol that leads Israel astray again, and he makes an idolatrous son whose name is Abimelech, which translates, "My father is king." A hint at the anti-idolatry activist has now become the idolater. We really are a perpetual factory of idols. So although hypocrisy may explain this ornate structure, there is an odd kind of moderation that could also be behind it. A recognition that sometimes the most zealous of anti-idolatry crusaders create their own new kind of idolatry through their efforts. A recognition that while some images might lead us astray, other kinds of art really can remind us that we worship a God who is larger than any one of us, a God who will not be manipulated. While some music might lead us to glorify ourselves, other music might open us up to the mystery of God in ways that reach beyond our words. An architectural statement made in the presence of powers that they alone can fix us or our problems, that says instead, "This is the only one who is worthy of our worship, the only one worthy of our ultimate allegiance." This isn't a God who can be conjured up at the seventh inning stretch, or the close of a political speech, or at the start of a war, and then packed away again until we decide we want a little divine intervention. No, this God is alive, demanding, yes, but demanding of allegiance that would save us from the ruin that comes when we give too much authority to human beings or to ideas or institutions that do not deserve that much allegiance. Demanding of allegiance to the God who commands us to love each other, who commands us to love each other as if we saw the image of God in each and every human being. Demanding of allegiance to the God who liberates slaves, who comforts grieving exiles, and gives the outcast a name better than sons and daughters. This is the only God worthy of our worship and our praise.